This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Anatoly Karlin. We're going to be talking about his ideological transformation and the war in Israel, the Israel versus Gaza war, and just global geopolitics. Anatoly, great having you back on the show.
Great to speak with you again, Robert. Good to be on the Stark the View as always.
The
Stark Truth.
Truth. Yeah, I've interviewed you. I think we've done shows like. I think it's been about a decade, perhaps more. So, yeah, for people who are listening, they can check out the archives and check out some of Anatoly's like older articles on UNS Review. But I guess to start things off, I think, do you want to kind of explain your ideological transformation? Because your views have changed a lot since, I'd say even since the last time we've talked. And you've basically gone from... You've always been interested in transhumanism, but you've basically gone from a nationalist to more of like a neoliberal globalist, and there's some comparisons with Richard Hanania as well, but this is primarily, you say, due to cognitive elitism, and obviously you still believe in HBD, but if you want to kind of give like an introduction of where you initially started out politically and ideologically and how have you evolved and where you're now.
Yes, sure. Well, broadly speaking, I was identified as a Russian nationalist and a transhumanist, unusual combination. I'm fully aware of that. So I was indeed blogging at the UNS Review until 2020, early 2021, I think, something like that. And mostly talking about geopolitics and futurism and HBD and the intelligence research. So my sort of like vision is that the vision I had before fast AI timelines appeared, so like the projected doubt to AGI collapsed from 2050 to 2030, literally, over the past couple of years. My vision is that it was seemed to be uncertain that we'd actually get to the singularity because there were also dysgenic trends in the production, especially in terms of intelligence.
You're saying it's happening sooner because of technological advancement, despite dysgenics.
Yeah, I mean, my sort of view is that they're no longer really relevant, assuming that AGI is 5 to 10 years away, as seems to be the latest predictions from the prediction markets. And basically, just to finish my thought, the idea is that you need some kind of sane, sustainable, sort of like right-wing society to exist to maximize the chances of at least some regions of the world avoiding an idiocracy. And it seemed to me that Putin's Russia seemed to be actually not that bad of a model as of like the late 2010s, early 2020s. And obviously, I think that the war has shown that the Putin regime is really can be legitimately described not so much sort of like as a sort of like this sort of competent nationalist regime that I partially envisaged it to be, although I was aware of many of its problems, but is in reality more of a kakistocracy, essentially, that doesn't really stand for anything and doesn't have any prospects. Now, I believe that reintegrated Russian lands could achieve the economies of scale needed to serve as a sort of like a viable alternate model to the sort of like the Western Empire dominated by the US, and which has its own problems to do with wokeness and so forth. But as the war has shown, it's really Thytoids who are a much sort of like ultimately bigger problem and burden on productivity and effectiveness than SJWs.
You would say that you're basically like a neoliberal globalist now, who believes in open borders.
Yes, although I would sort of qualify the comparison with Hanania or with Richard Spencer, some people have pointed out. I mean, Richard Spencer seems to like have this sort of like neocon outlook and wants to utilize the war with Russia as a method to mobilize white identity in Europe and the US. I personally don't have basically zero interest in that, and to the extent that it extends the war, it comes off as rather Gaulish, in fact. And I certainly don't really have much in common, I think, in terms of specifics with Hanania, in the sense that Hanania, whereas Hoste was the sort of like socially conservative right-wing person, like really, really right-wing, Hanania is instead this anti-woke, intellectual dark web, American supremacist, frankly neocon, to be honest, but like smarter than like your ordinary normie neocons, but in that sort of like general area. And I don't, it seems pretty bizarre to me to sort of like, abandon Russian nationalism and then embrace some other nationalism, like be it American or Israeli, as in Hanania's case. Or as some Russian nationalists have accused me of becoming a Ukrainian nationalist, that's obviously also pretty absurd in the light of the view that I don't actually support Ukraine. As in, I have been calling for a peace treaty for a year now, basically. That was my basically publicly stated position on Twitter and so on.
You never supported Putin's war efforts?
I supported them last year, like two years ago. Yeah, I sort of own that. Yeah, I don't deny that. Because I thought that it was a normal state which would fight the war normally, it would conquer Ukraine in 1 to 2 months. The prediction markets, for what it's worth, agreed with me. So people criticized me a lot for getting that part extremely wrong in February, that it would take like a week or two or a month at most. But if you actually look at the prediction markets, they were basically saying the same thing, like 95%, 98% chance that Russian troops would be in Kharkiv before in March. Same thing for Odessa. So I don't, if the war had actually been thought more competently, probably not really the optimal podcast to go into details, but basically, if conscripts had been used, if Belarusian troops had been used, if mobilization had happened in April instead of September and in a lackluster way, if the bridges across the Dnieper had been bombed from the outset, if even like the barracks containing Ukrainian troops had been bombed on day one, whereas in fact they were avoided in the first few days, allowing them to disperse. I mean, if like really lamentably things, and I mean, I can expand this list by tenfold, had been done, then I think that it's pretty like extremely likely that the war would have been won. And this is what both prediction markets and American analysts, for that matter, the Kiev in 3 days meme, by the way, comes from the Americans. That would have probably been much closer to reality than what actually happened.
So your views on Putin have overall changed since the war. So you're generally, you would say that you're disillusioned with Russian nationalism, and would you say that you're overall bearish on Russia's future?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't obviously Putin adopted many parts of the Russian nationalist program in the past few years. So, I've written about that, Russia's nationalist turn written a few months before the war, which has aged very badly in that respect. But obviously they're not sort of the exact same thing. I mean, even the Russian nationalists, they have a very broad sort of like spectrum of views. Some of them are anti-war for that matter. People like Stelkov, they were sort of like demanding full economic manpower and ideological mobilization from day one and criticizing the conduct of the war and saying that it wouldn't lead to anything good the way it was being fought. So again, Putin and Russian nationalism, two rather separate things at the end of the day, although intersectional to some extent. However, realistically speaking, I think that what the war has shown in general is that Russia, like even had Russia won in Ukraine, it really wouldn't have sort of made a cardinal difference. It's basically what the war revealed is that it's just too creaky a state formation to actually serve as any viable alternative model. And basically, you could sort of paper that over during peacetime, but during wartime, these sort of deficiencies really come into the open and can no longer be here papered over. Like you could sort of falsify election results, you could falsify COVID numbers and flunk the vaccination campaign. Not even do the census properly. The census in 2020 was carried out much in 2021. Sorry, its quality was actually lower than in 2010 or 2002. So you had all these sort of warning signs flashing during peacetime about Russian state capacity and its decline under the late Putin regime. But the war really sort of threw out into the open that it's not a very sustainable or viable structure.
You have these different narratives about Russia. You have the Z shill saying that Russia is doing great, and then you have you have people like Peter Zeihan who says that Russia has been totally devastated by the war, including economically. Are you overall bearish or bullish on Russia's future?
I'm sort of not going to be making any bold predictions, but what I will make is that aside from my incorrect prediction about the war being short, I sort of did actually mostly call everything else correctly.
It got coverage in New York Times, I think.
I think Ross Douthat wrote about it. Just to sort of remind people, I predicted that the war would actually happen late December, I think, I was sort of flipped to the viewpoint that it was very likely going to happen. By late 2022, and I have the receipts, my outlook, which I can provide the receipts on Twitter, is that my long-term vision for the war would be that it most likely would remain a stalemate. I suppose you could sort of compare it to the U.S. Civil War, with, say, Russia being the Union, much more industrially developed and a bigger population, and the South being more ideologically driven more motivated, except for the difference that in this case the Union successfully blockaded the Confederacy. Whereas Russia can't blockade Ukraine. In fact, it's sort of picking off the Black Sea fleet one by one. And it shares a land border with NATO. And NATO is ideologically totally aligned with Ukraine in a way that obviously France and Britain were not aligned with the Confederacy. So you have what you have. There's theoretical scenarios in which Russia can still win, but they strike me as extremely theoretical. Like either the war continues for another five grinding years, and Ukraine basically bleeds out of manpower by that point, assuming that there's no sort of drastic technological changes. Which again is a very dangerous assumption considering the exponential growth in drone technologies. Or as I said, there's going to be some radical technological breakthrough, probably in the drone related realm at this point, that sort of tilts the tide. But leaving that aside, I think that the current lines are here to stay. There's probably going to be some minor shifts that way or another. But most likely, I'm not excluding anything, but most likely the amphibious operation across the Dnieper by Ukraine will not succeed or come to anything. Probably this will eventually take Avdiivka like a month before Putin's the election, to sort of like serve as a sort of like a symbolic retarded kind of victory, but which is strategically meaningless in the large picture. But otherwise, I expect the front lines to remain pretty much where they are for the foreseeable future.
Do you expect Putin to remain in power? Are there any viable political challenges to Putin, taking into account the role of U.S. deep state interfering?
I mean, obviously, that's sort of like rather meaningless to talk about viable challenges to Putin in the since Russia was a like a not a totalitarian regime, pretty much even before the war. Now, I mean, it's I mean it's totally meaningless to talk of any challenges to Putin. He will get reelected in March. Probably will get like legitimately 60-70%. There'll be a fraud, which adds another 10 percentage points or 15 percentage points, as is usual for Putin. I think that after the war ends, and I mean, assuming that it ends in a draw, I mean, if Russia loses, it seems to be rather unlikely now that Russia loses and, like ends up sort of like losing Crimea and so on. In that case, I think Putin is pretty much, cooked, regardless. But if the war ends as I expect, this is sort of like dies down because of the mutual inability to make any progress, and Zelensky understands that it's sort of like throwing away hundreds of thousands of more people for like this sort of like prospectless offensives is not a good idea. I expect some major problems for Putin, like 2 years, 3 years down the line. Simply because once the war ends, it's sort of like not very kosher to question the war's conduct right now, because that's sort of like not something that it's extremely socially acceptable to do during wartime for understandable reasons. But if and when the war ends, I think there will be serious questions about why Russia lost 100,000 like people, essentially, and so whether it was worth it, and what Russia got out of it, and why was sort of Putin's sort of agents buying up parts for his yachts in Europe in the middle of the war, instead of actually doing industrial mobilization and putting the economy on a war footing. Like all kinds of questions about the war's conduct, about the like the extreme corruption in the elites that resulted in this pathetic outcome. I think these kinds of questions will come to the fore 2025, 2026, 2027, and I'm sort of like not at all sure that Putinism will actually survive past 2030.
So with the Israel-Gaza war, you're basically neutral, as am I. Can you comment on Israel's response to the terror attack in Gaza and some of both the practical and humanitarian arguments, and how much criticisms do you have for both sides? Are you generally, would you say equally, or you're much more critical of Israel?
At the very start, I said that it's a very bad idea to actually take sides in Middle Eastern squabbles, and realistically, that would have been the correct approach with respect to the Ukraine as well, to sort of like oppose it at the beginning. But Hamas attacked Israel and carried out a pogrom essentially. So an Israeli response was inevitable. But when you're talking about basically an open air prison in a very small territory, heavily built up, you're not sort of like, even with relatively restrictive rules of engagement, and I don't think Israel is trying particularly hard at that, you're going to automatically, by default, get massive amounts of casualties. So you could sort of like be cheering on Israel in the first few days or even first couple of weeks. But there is sort of like the war crimes and like hospital bombings and church bombings and so on, over time they will sort of like start accumulating, as they already, just as I said they would, and you will sort of spend an increasing portion of your time trying to justify war crimes of different kinds, which doesn't strike me as a productive pursuit or one which will is very conducive to building up your social capital. To get things done. And it's very funny to me that the Dietoids have been fooled into sort of like getting like enthusiastically behind Israel as usual. Like, you know, you have the IDW ringleaders, you have based Shapiro calling on the men of the West to fight the Islamic menace. Of course, we know that most likely this will, like, good chance this basically creates another refugee wave further down the line, and then those sort of like same hate speech laws that they're now celebrating, like again, which are being used against some like pro-Hamas people, they're just going to be used against those same Dietoids, in my opinion, like in a few months' time. It's completely predictable, and Dietoids keep falling for it over and over again, and this is like one of the myriad reasons why I don't want to have anything to do with those losers at this point.
There are different like scenarios about escalation. One scenario is that it remains just Israel and Gaza, which is not going to have like a broader effect other than the refugee crisis. Then there's the scenario where it escalates into a broader regional war involving Hezbollah and Iranian Shia proxies in Iraq and Syria. And then there's direct confrontation with Iran. The third one would be direct confrontation with Iran. And then fourth would be Russia gets involved in World War III, which sounds, maybe that sounds like a total hyperbole and like nightmare scenarios where like the Strait of Hormuz is interrupted and it impacts global oil supply. Ranking like those four different scenarios, which one do you think is the most likely? From like World War III to a regional war to just staying in Gaza.
Well, in a normal timeline, I would say that large-scale escalation is unlikely because the U.S. has sort of signaled that it's behind Israel. And the Arab countries, they sort of like don't really care about Palestine, unfortunately. I mean, the sort of like the ethical thing to do would be to just take in Palestinian refugees, but nobody seems to be interested in doing that, and the West isn't sort of like very enthusiastic about it either, to their discredit. So yeah, but that aside, I don't think that there's a huge chance of a major escalation. But what I would say, however, and we're sort of like going off on a sort of esoteric tangent, I would say. But I might sort of qualify the chances of a big war, like a really big war, to be perhaps substantially larger than conventional prediction markets would suggest, or like the assumption that we live in a conventional timeline would suggest. It's basically this sort of like idea I've been sort of like having is that, again, the turning to that thing about AGI timelines. If we allow the safetyist perspective that AGI is dangerous and that there's a big gap between AGI timelines and AI alignment timelines, and also assuming some that anthropic reasoning is valid, so basically this idea that we are more likely to observe to be in a world that makes it, that survives AGI, than we do in a doomed world. Because if it's a surviving world, there'll be more beings in the future to recall or remember or simulate current observers. That's basically like 101 to this sort of like this anthropic shadow effect. If these assumptions are all correct, then there could be sort of some catastrophic event that might happen to like basically contract the gap between the AGI timelines and the AI alignment timelines, like the gap between them. And sort of like one of the more obvious ways in which it could happen is indeed a third world war, especially one that ends up destroying the chip fabs in Taiwan, which are the world's most advanced.
Like a full-blown World War III involving direct confrontation with Russia and China, that sounds like hyperbole, but I could see a quasi-World War III where it's like a series of proxy wars, so Russia in Ukraine, what's going on now in Israel. You have like Armenia, Azerbaijan, and just these all these different proxy wars scattered throughout the Middle East, Central Asia, Eastern Europe, and Africa. Like something like that is plausible, not like a full-blown World War III, like more like a series of proxy wars.
Well, as I said, I just sort of want to clarify. I mean, I'm not expecting a World War III per se, if under the assumption that we live in a normal timeline. But as we sort of like approach the technological singularity, if AGI timelines are short, then there's a possibility that increasingly strange things will happen as we approach it, just due to those anthropic shadow effects that I mentioned previously. So it's basically an interesting scenario to consider, not as a sort of like a certainty or even something that I would necessarily bet on.
Do you have thoughts on the impacts of the conflict with Israel and Gaza on U.S. domestic policies as far as basically how Zionism is right-coded? And obviously Jews tend to be liberal, and the Democratic Party is being split between a more Biden's fairly pro-Israel, then you have like the Squad and the progressives who are more pro-Palestinian, and then there's like some decline. You have all these different factions, like there could be a decline in soft power for Israel, and the issue becomes totally polarized left versus right. And then also you see like in Europe, it's actually, at least in the short term, Europe's becoming more nationalistic and kind of using Hamas as an excuse to be nationalistic. So all these different domestic political angles in the U.S. and Europe, your general thoughts?
Well, look, I think the safe assumption is that rightoids are retards, and they will always find a way to fuck up. And I think that associating themselves very strongly with Israel isn't going to do any favors for them, since the sort of like the legitimacy of the Israeli cause, it was high immediately after the pogroms. But as the war continues and as things get more and more fucked up in Gaza, I think that that sort of thing will start hurting them more and more. And I mean, that's not even like going into the other sort of like issues like abortion, obviously not going to go into that, but obviously the sort of like obsession is hurts the Republicans a lot. And there's also like even somebody like Vivek, who I kind of like actually. But he's sort of like dancing about how fossil fuels are great and how global warming is a lie and so on. I mean, I don't think global warming is something to be concerned about, especially in light of short AI timelines. But you have to consider that by current sort of projections, there's a prediction that the models say that next year is very likely going to be an exceptionally hot year, the hottest on record. To date, you'll be sort of like sweltering next summer. And, like even in these sort of like total details, they are thinking of ways to sort of potentially, trap themselves. So even though Biden isn't polling very well, I mean, my sort of bet is that,
you predicted it on a show we did a couple years ago that it would be Trump and Biden.
Yeah, I did, yes. And it's looking like that. And I think that even though the polls aren't looking very good for Biden right now, I think like simply because Republicans are like dietoids and dietoids are retards, they will find a way to screw things up like one way or another. It's just a like a certainty, metaphysical certainty. And the most likely, I think Biden will win. Even Biden will win. And if Biden is replaced by Newsom, which is a possibility, then I think it's been virtually guaranteed.
And you think even like RFK could actually end up taking more votes from Trump than Biden?
Well, I think it's obvious that RFK will take more votes.
Yeah, because I would vote for RFK, and if I was, and maybe like in the past, like I was a tepid Trump supporter in the past, but I'd vote for RFK. So that I kind of see that just even though in the past he would have been seen as more left-leaning, in many ways he is. I think the like anti-establishment versus establishment dichotomy kind of like Trump's left versus right for many people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for what it's worth, I like Newsom. I like Vivek, actually, like the only Republican candidate I somewhat like. And Biden, I suppose, is better than the sort of like the other Republicans. I'm totally done with Trump, not to mention DeSantis or the other losers, like Nikki Haley, that neocon. Totally uninterested.
Yeah, Yeah, I agree about Trump totally uninterested in any of the Republicans for the most part. And with it was interesting is like I wrote this article about this like rise in anti-Israel or anti-Semitic sentiment on the left, and I think my last article made the point it's basically like an extension of CRT and anti-whiteness, but applied towards like Israel and Jewish issues instead. Do you see, mm-hmm. how do you see this getting resolved? Do you see the left actually becoming anti-Israel or anti-Semitic, or do you see some successful like version of CRT that treats anti-Semitism like the same way that has zero tolerance for anti-Semitism, but also strengthens CRT? And on that issue, and just like broader the future of like wokeness and identity politics.
Okay, yeah, just to address that question, I agree with that perspective. The left, in my opinion, it sort of has a peculiar anti-Semitism in that it's actually logically consistent, because the left, as we know, one of its core features of the sort of like the standard left, not like dissidents, but like the mainstream left, is that they are blank slatist. And so logically, Jewish success, I mean, it must be sort of a result of their privilege, just like relative white success. But if they pay the privations, if they sort of like acknowledge their privilege, then that's fine. And obviously they have issues with Israel as a sort of like a Zionist settler state. And to be fair, I mean, if you look at the opinion polls, opinion in Israel is like radical, like right-wing radical racialist to a far greater extent than in any European country, like not even like the most based European countries like Hungary, anywhere close to that. Like if you just look at, say, like poll questions, like would you marry an Arab or like a Christian, like someone from like outside your religion. So yeah, it's a specific society in that respect. So I don't think like that leftist anti-Zionism is even like paradoxical, or like if you're sort of like against nationalism, then I think that anti-Zionism is sort of like just being consistent with anti-nationalism per se. Now, right-wingers, obviously, they either support Israel because they sort of like it as a model, or because it's a tactical alliance for them. You have that with Orban, actually, with like some of the like based so-called based Republicans, I suppose, but then you also have right-wing anti-Semites, but they are anti-Semites for like Nazi racialist reasons, like race war now type of reasons. That kind of anti-Semitism is obviously orders of magnitude more virulent than leftist sort of like anti-Semitism, because the latter is just basically like the sort of like criticisms of white for being privileged and pressing like you know minorities and so on. It's just a logical extension of that. Whereas the like the Nazi types, they're like they would really sort of like fire up the ovens again if they had the opportunity.
Could you see like wokeness waning away and being like instead seeing like a resurgence of a return to a kind of establishmentarian centrism?
I mean, I think it happened to some extent, right? The influence of wokeness, I think, had peaked about 2 years ago, 2-3 years ago, and has in tandem with Trump, actually, funnily enough. Now that there's sort of like old man Biden, who's this sort of like inoffensive fellow, who it's hard to hate, really. I think we sort of like went through that before. He just sort of like doesn't excite passions as much, and it seems that like wokeness has just sort of like somewhat. I mean, obviously it exists and it's still problematic, but it's considerably less of an issue than it was before.
There's like these two competing narratives. One is like turbo Americanism and like the end of history. Then you also have like the collapse bros, and then those who are saying that China is going to become dominant and the U.S. will lose its world reserve currency status. So it revolves about like society, societal collapse versus end of history, Fukuyama in general, but also specifically about like American hegemony. But what do you think about those two competing narratives? And would you agree with one, or is there like nuance in between?
I'm substantially more skeptical about China than I was 2-3 years ago. It's been making a lot of mistakes with COVID, with hampering its tech sector, the crackdowns. So he extended his terms, and initially, sort of like there were some questions. I mean, like there's traditional questions to do with people extending their terms. It's usually a symbol of cronyism being entrenched, and that seems to be panning out essentially in China. So I'm actually significantly less on China's prospects, economic prospects, and especially its soft power prospects, to a much less extent than I was a decade ago. I mean, I was a China bull since 2008. I mean, I'm again sort of being accused of flipping my views, but I'm just adjusting them to the reality that
it was sort of national. It was national. Take on China.
Yeah. It was no, I don't, because he's like a hyperbolic, like a grifter, who says weird, like apocalyptic stuff about how China sort of like is this paper tiger, essentially. So no, I don't disagree with him. But what I'm saying is that China's sort of GDP is probably going to top out at maybe 50%. Maybe a maximum twice as high as the US, where this versus like the three or four times that I previously expected. The US is forming increasingly close ties with not just its traditional allies in Europe and East Asia, but also with India, very importantly. And to a large extent, simply because of Chinese mistakes in continually provoking India for no good reason. So I think that those two blocks, if I had to, and obviously the AI revolution, it's almost entirely an American thing. So there's much more reasons to be relatively bullish on the US relative to China than it was three years ago, in my opinion.
Do you think America's main vulnerability, it obviously has a lot of strengths, including natural resources, is its main volatility political strife, or you generally actually are optimistic about America's short-term and long-term future?
Well, I mean, resources don't really matter. I mean, if resources mattered, then the Middle East, ten countries, Russia, would be like superpowers still. But the political divisions, well, they seem to be less now than they were 5 years ago, and nothing really happened. And in fact, there's arguments to be made that countries that stifle a political division just ends up manifesting itself in various dysfunctions instead. So there's actually a case to be made for political divisiveness, in my opinion. It's just part of the division of powers at the end of the day.
And do you have thoughts on the state of the economy as far as it relates to AI? Because on one hand, there are some people saying that like there are all these like strong bearish trends of like a severe recession and amounts of debt. And on one hand, there's an argument that AI can create this immense economic boom that can create immense prosperity, obviously, for the stock market. But then the flip side of that is that income inequality will exacerbate, and then we'll see like mass unemployment with automation. So what are your thoughts on the impacts of automation on the economy?
In my opinion, its productivity is going to soar, and initially that's going to translate into higher wages, although potentially as we go further into the 2020s, you will have a crisis of overproduction in sort of like traditional Marxist terms, ironically, and you will then have to sort of start various schemes to implement UBI to make sure that the productivity boons from the AI revolution are equitably shared across the US and hopefully ultimately the world at large. Because in my opinion, AI alignment is very important, and for people to treat it as important, every society and individuals at large around the world have to sort of feel invested into the system. But that's sort of slightly different. Like you're asking about the recession, I think the recession has passed. I mean, the time to worry about the recession was a year ago, in my opinion. I mean, I sold all my crypto at the peak in 2021 in November, and I didn't buy back for all of 2022. And to be honest, I sort of actually missed the bottom because I was expecting Bitcoin at like 10K and Ethereum at like $600, and in reality, it never went below like 15K and $1,000 respectively. But then I realized that that the session is over. It's not going to be happening. The ETFs are coming, and the AI is going to settle on Ethereum at the end of the day, since it's sort of like the most rigorous framework for like holding value in the digital realm, in my opinion. And so I just bought back into crypto like this summer. So, like you could sort of see lingering problems with, value stocks, I suppose.
What about the bond markets? But there's volatility in the bond markets.
Well, as I said, I think the, sort of like the acute crisis phase has passed. I'm not expecting, anything.
Do you think that inflation has set back the timeline for UBI?
I mean, I think UBI is going to be primarily driven by sort of automation, and eventually there'll come a point when high-skilled workers will no longer be getting reassigned, but will just be actively replaced by bots. And at that point, there will be extreme political agitation and the lobby for UBI. So could happen by the late 2020s, early 2030s, I expect, if the optimistic timelines continue to hold.
Before we wrap up, do you have anything else you want to add about the AI timelines alignment and also the biosingularity?
Oh, okay, yeah, sure. I mean, I'll sort of integrate this with current plans for resuming blogging. Over the past 2 years, I've mostly been doing other stuff, and so far as commentary was concerned, I was mostly just shit posting on Twitter. But now I plan to shift to actually resume blogging, and quite imminently, I have an article that's almost ready. Unfortunately, it wasn't published in time for this podcast, but it will be by the time this podcast comes out on your website, where I sort of go over why I sort of abandoned my lingering right-wing views or values I still subscribed to a year ago. And I will also sort of write about what I will be blogging about in the future. And basically, in my opinion, we have a big problem in the sense that there's this sort of like attitude in AI where you can sort of either rush ahead and then risk doom, because if alignment fails or we get a Malthusian AI scenario, and since they're much more competitive than humans, this could potentially lead to a scenario in which they make the biosphere economically unviable, essentially. So I think there's serious concerns raised by the so-called Yudskowskiites and so on, and I'm sort of like not really into effective altruism at all. Effective accelerationism.
But on the other hand, accelerationism, not effective altruism.
Yeah, effective accelerationism. I think it's a dangerous ideology in the sense that it's either a death cult if taken to its logical conclusions, or more realistically, many of them just don't believe in AGI, period, because they have this idea that AGI will come and like GDP will double or whatever, will fly to Mars, like Tesla stocks, SpaceX stocks will go up by 10x, but otherwise life will continue as normal. No, life isn't going to continue as normal, bucko, in a sort of like an AGI scenario. I think AGI is dangerous, but I also think that pausing AI by government fiat is also very dangerous, because it's actually ineffective. It won't actually do anything, because algorithms themselves are improving at a rapid rate, and hardware is as well. I think you need controls on hardware, but you also need increased funding to sort of like accelerate like the expansion of the biosphere's thinking capacity through embryo selection, genomics of IQ, stuff like Neuralink.
You think even artificial wombs, or is that way off in the future?
Well, I mean, I think that would be good for natalism, although not probably would actually be pro-eugenic as well, in the sense that pregnancy and child rearing exerts a big opportunity cost on educated professional women. But yeah, it's fissile wombs, although it's not sort of like a big element. I mean, I think the really important stuff to get done though is intelligence augmentation and life extension, because I don't sort of like want to die, but I don't want to sort of like kill everything either. So, like, preferably, you would have a world in which people can live for several centuries or millennia or however long it takes to figure out AI alignment, and then see, then to consider whether it's sort of like worth launching it. And the problem is though that I don't think AI can be paused by government fired. I think in the short term you need hardware caps, like on TSMC production, eventually you will sort of need to like reformat, in my opinion, the hardware base basically emit safety ZK proofs of safe compute, preferably onto a public blockchain, so that it's verifiable in a decentralized fashion that it's all safe compute. For what it's worth, Darko on Twitter has some very good ideas on this, which I sort of recommend you check out. But in any case, this is the kind of stuff that I think is vastly more important than culture wars, than like the gays or the the wokes and so on. It's vastly more important than the tragic but meaningless village squabbles in Eastern Europe or the Middle East, which will probably, in all likelihood, nobody will even care about in circa 2050. So this is sort of the kind of thing I am going to be reorienting towards when I relaunch my blog, my Substack, which is called Nucellization. And it should be up by the time this podcast gets posted.
So Nucellization, that's your new blog, and most of your articles are on AnatolyKarelin.com.
Yes, my archive is at akarelin.com, and I will continue posting like various political shit and stuff that interests me, book reviews, travel reviews, and so on, to akarelin.com. But the serious, mostly futurism-related stuff, as I see it, will accrue to Nucellization from now on.
Anatoly Karelin, a great show. Thank you so much for being on.
Okay, thank you, Robert.